This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by Sprout. Sprout is the first ever discount club for pregnancy and parenthood. Born out of the reality of just how expensive having a baby can be, Sprout is here to help you save at what we know to be a truly expensive time. Founded by Sophie, mum to two, Sophie found the adjustment to statutory maternity pay a challenge. And when reflecting on her time as a student, when she had lots of lovely discounts, she found it crazy that as a new parent, there wasn't anything out there for those with little ones. And so Sprout was born. Since launching in 2020, Sprout has now saved its members over £28,000 and now partners with over 90 brands, including Jojo Mum & Baby, My First Years, Mamma Mio Skincare, Natal Active, Bloom & Wild, Latched, Bugaboo and so many more to offer members repeat discounts to help them save. Whether you are pregnant, your partner is pregnant, you're adopting, have little Sprouts or older ones, membership is open to all parents and parents-to-be. Either join for a year or life, and you can now buy a membership for a friend to help them save too. A lifetime membership to Sprout comes with a free gift box. And as a listener of this podcast, by using the code BUNINTHEOVEN, you can save 50% on a lifetime membership and sign up today for only £10. Yes, that is access for life for only £10 by using the code BUNINTHEOVEN. To join the club, simply head to sproutperks.com, choose the lifetime membership and enter the code BUNINTHEOVEN, all lowercase and all one word, and you'll be given instant access to the discounts so you can start saving straight away. Man meets woman, man marries woman, man has sex with woman, woman gets pregnant. This is the story we so often hear about how children are made, but this is just not the reality for everyone. My name's Holly Grant. I'm the founder of The Bump Plan, and you're listening to Bun in the Oven, a podcast that explores the myriad of challenges and routes to becoming and being a parent. For the last 11 years, I've worked across the globe as a Pilates instructor and advanced pre- and postnatal fitness specialist. During that time, I've worked with thousands of people, have heard hundreds of stories about fertility, infertility, pregnancy, and parenthood, and have learned so much about the often rocky road to becoming a parent, which I find fascinating. Bun in the Oven will dive into the many different ways children are brought into this world and what parenting really involves. I hope you find this podcast a huge source of support and that it helps open all our minds. In this week's episode, we'll be talking all about endometriosis, its symptoms and its effect on fertility. My guests are Professor of Gynecology Andrew Horn and one of my favourite people, Louise Abdallah. Please note that we do also discuss miscarriage in this episode.
And I remember the day before one of the fitness retreats being in Tesco's buying some bits and bobs. And it was the day before my period. And I just remember like almost collapsing. Like I was on the floor in Tesco's and I was like on my own. I was like, God, I have to get to the painkillers. I have to find the painkiller aisle. And that's really then when I was like, this is just so, so not normal. And by that point, I did know that it was endometriosis. It had been diagnosed.
Andrew Horn is Professor of Gynecology and founder and co-director of the Expect Centre for Pelvic Pain and Endometriosis at the University of Edinburgh. He's a world-leading researcher in women's health problems with a focus on endometriosis and pelvic pain and has published over 150 scientific papers. He is trustee to Endometriosis UK and has co-authored a book on endometriosis for patients called The Expert's Guide to Treat, Manage and Live Well with Your Symptoms. I still can't believe he found the time to talk to us. He is an incredible, incredible man. My other guest today is Louise Abdallah, who is one of the funniest, loveliest and honest women I know. Married to the king of positivity, Mr. PMA, Faisal Abdallah, she is a huge support behind the scenes, although is far too modest to admit how much she does to grow his brand. With a background in PR, they make a great team alongside their long-awaited son, Rafi. In this episode, we'll be talking about endometriosis and the effects it can have on a woman's everyday life and their desire to have children. Andrew shares the clinical elements of the condition so perfectly and shares his advice for those suffering, whilst Louise gives us an insight into living with the condition. Louise's honesty and Andrew's knowledge will help so many women push for a diagnosis, I'm sure, as it currently takes on average 7 years to be diagnosed.
Louise and Andrew, thank you so much for being on today's podcast.
Hello.
Hi. Hi.
It's lovely to see you both. And Louise, we never get to see each other anymore because of COVID, but it's so nice to see your face.
No, Holly, it's because of children. Like, life stops when you have children. Why don't they tell us this?
That's true. We definitely had more fun and saw each other more pre-babies. So to most of our listeners, we'll have realised already, but today's topic is really about endometriosis and how that can affect a woman's life, their fertility journey, their choices around having children, and their everyday life. And I'm joined by two incredible people, as always, who'll be talking about both what it feels like to suffer with endometriosis, but also Andrew will be talking about the facts. He is the person to know if you want to know more about endometriosis. I'm really grateful that you're both here with me today. So Louise, let's start with you. It would be great to get an idea of who you are, who you live with. So give us a bit of an insight.
Oh, Holly, I don't want to disappoint people. I'm just a mum. Like, I live with my husband, Faisal, who's a bit of an Instagram... he's an Instagrammer, and my little boy Rafi, who's an absolute nut job, three-year-old, just like red-headed wild child. And my life now is just like running around after the two of them, really. Done lots in my career before that, but yeah, at the moment I'm just a mum, and a mum to my two lovely cats as well, who do count as children, can I just say.
I think in some ways pets are actually more hard work than children.
Yes, absolutely. Just ask Faisal, he hates them.
But you describe yourself as just a mum, but a mum is such a huge job. I genuinely find that the days that I'm working, so in the office, are much easier than the days that I'm parenting. But it's so tempting and so common to kind of downplay it, isn't it? And to describe it as just a mum.
Yeah, and do you know what it is? I think it's when you've had like careers before, and then that's your thing. It's, you do feel a bit like, oh, is that all I do now? But yeah, obviously, it's absolutely knackering. Like, I've never worked such long hours in my life. yeah, it's a weird one.
But before you had Rafi, you were also quite a big part of Faisal's brand. You know, you're similar to me and my husband. You worked with Faisal, and I still do that.
Yeah, I still do. It's just a lot less formal. It's just like fitting it in wherever I have time. Like when Raph is in bed, then I'll quickly do some content and like social media stuff. It's not as full on as it was. Like, he did have his book out previously. Like, I think, yeah, while I was pregnant. So that was really full on. But there's no like major, because of COVID, no major projects on at the moment. So yeah, I've had quite a nice break. If you can call a parenting in COVID a break. I don't really know if it's a break at all.
It's a weird one, you know. Half of my life as a mum has been outside of COVID, and half been in COVID, and it's definitely different parenting during a global pandemic, isn't it?
Much harder, much less options and less places to go to like wear them out, for sure.
Lonely, I think that. Motherhood is quite lonely at the best of times, and then when you add in not being allowed to see other people, it becomes much more lonely.
Yeah, definitely.
So obviously we know that you have endometriosis, had endometriosis. Talk us through that then. So as far back as you remember, because I know before we started talking or before we started recording, you even said, you know, you have to really think back because it's a long journey. So maybe start at the beginning if you can.
Yeah, that's really strange actually, because I've had my operation and stuff now. It never goes away. You know, when you say you have it or you had it, you always have it because there's no cure, but when you have no symptoms, it tends to go to the back of your head. But then when you do have it and you have the symptoms present, it's all consuming. It's literally, I remember it's just all I thought about because it's all I felt. I was officially diagnosed with it about a year and a half before I was operated on. So I was operated on in July 2017. So it's probably around the end of 2015 or something like that I was diagnosed with it, purely because we were trying for a baby and we were having problems getting pregnant, and I went to the doctor with that specifically, and that's when it was investigated. But prior to that, like, there was so many issues, but it's such a difficult thing because with endometriosis the symptoms can apply to so many things. So when you're going to the doctor with sort of individual symptoms like backache or headaches or painful periods, unless those symptoms are all put together, it's very hard to diagnose. And I think Andrew will sort of confirm or deny this, I don't know, but I think a lot of women are diagnosed when they are having fertility problems, and then they are those problems are investigated. But yeah, it was a long ongoing thing. I think looking back to when I first started my periods, it wasn't as bad, but I remember them being like really painful, really heavy. And I actually went on to the contraceptive pill like really young, just to sort of try and have lighter periods, but didn't really think that was an issue. I didn't think that was like that big a deal. Because at school, you're told you have periods, they hurt. Like that's just what you're told. You don't know what level of pain is normal or not normal. So that was sort of ignored. And I think the pill masked a lot of the symptoms. So often it's prescribed to sort of help with endometriosis and the symptoms of it. So I think probably that's what happened when I came off the pill just for a break. I decided I had enough, like in my mid-20s. That's when it started getting really, really bad. But again, I was like, oh, maybe it's because I've been on the pill for so long and this is how it's meant to be. Like I hadn't had a proper period that wasn't sort of in the break from the pill for so many years. And it just got worse and worse and worse. Yeah, just so bad. Like I was sat down, as you say earlier, thinking about what it used to be like. And it just got awful to the point. I remember you saying you sort of worked with your partner. Me and Faisal used to do fitness retreats. And I remember the day before one of the fitness retreats being in Tesco's buying some bits and bobs for the retreat. I don't know what it was. And it was the day before my period. And I just remember like almost collapsing. Like I was on the floor in Tesco's and I was like, on my own. I was like, God, I have to get to the painkillers. I have to find the painkiller aisle. And I was panting. I was literally like, it was like, like contractions almost, just such pain. And that's really then when I was like, this is just so, so not normal. And by that point, I did know that it was endometriosis. It had been sort of diagnosed. But yeah, I just remember it getting worse and worse and just not really having a clue what was going on, but just knowing that it wasn't like I wasn't right. I just didn't feel like me anymore. I was just exhausted. I just lost my spark almost. It was just a lot. That's all I remember, really.
Is the pain only around period time or is it in between? Is it something you just experience once a month?
For me, it was, I'd get twinges around ovulation. But before I was trying for a baby, I didn't even know what ovulation was. I didn't know there was something in the middle of the month. Like, until you try for a baby and then you're obsessed and you feel like every twinge in your body, don't you? But I didn't know that's what it was. But around my period, yeah, like a couple of days before, and during my period, like the first couple of days. But I also found, and again, I don't know if this is a thing, but Andrew might be able to like talk about this more, but I found with certain foods I was eating, like I have sort of, I don't know if I have IBS, I have sort of IBS very similar to IBS symptoms, that certain foods around those times of like menstruation, if I were to have things that cause flare-ups like dairy or raw onions or stuff, that would bring on such a bad attack, and like it seemed to exacerbate the symptoms of the endometriosis like really, really badly. Like I need an ambulance sort of bad. But yeah, I think it was just around that. Like, look, it is hard to remember because it was a few years ago. But yeah, I think it was just around the time of my period. Then in terms of the pain, but in general, like tiredness, the backache, stuff like that, it felt like that was all through the month. I don't remember ever feeling awake for like a good few years, like just feeling tired all the time.
I'm presuming that the fact that you're saying that you're having to try to remember is a good sign.
yeah definitely.
What your experience at the moment.
Yeah, although having said that, then it becomes a different thing. It becomes like, since my operation, there's the anxiety of it returning. I know it's there, it's in my body, and there's just always the anxiety of it coming back. And I'm quite open with like our fertility battles, like we're trying to conceive again now and we're having problems. And so at the back of my mind, it's now coming up again, those feelings of like, oh God, is this it? Like the thought, like, should I go to the doctor? But then really not wanting to go to a doctor because I just don't want to have to go through that journey again. It does never go away. Like the pain goes, but for me, the anxiety around it never completely disappears. Like I'm always aware that it's potentially there.
that's really, really helpful and really honest, Louise. Thank you so much. So, Andrew, then, can you explain what endometriosis is?
Endometriosis is remarkably common. We think it affects around 1 in 10 women, which, you know, within the UK equates to 1.5 million women. So huge numbers of sufferers of endometriosis. And it's a condition whereby tissue like the lining of the womb is found outside of the womb. And the commonest places are within the pelvis, on the wall of the pelvis or on the ovary, but it can even be found in the lung or in the tummy button in more unusual places. And the big problem with endometriosis is that it's associated with pain, as we've just heard from Louise, and also in some cases difficulty getting pregnant. And the pain can be quite wide-ranging, as we've heard. Classically, we talk about endometriosis causing very severe period pain, or what we call cyclical pain. So it could come around ovulation, as you found, or at certain times of the cycle. But in many women, it can come all the time, or it can come randomly. And it can also be pain that comes, for example, with opening the bowels, with passing urine, or pain with sex, which is obviously a big problem as well. In terms of the fertility side of things, whilst the majority of women who have endometriosis, up to around 60 or 70%, don't tend to have problems getting pregnant, there is this proportion, as we've just heard, who do have problems conceiving. And we don't really understand why that is. There's lots of theories. Obviously, if you have tissue within the pelvic area near the ovaries, near the womb, there's potential that it alters these environments and affects ovulation, affects the implantation and development of the embryo and the pregnancy. But we don't fully understand why the difficulties with getting pregnant occur.
Do we know why some women have it and some women don't? Do we know what causes it?
We don't. Again, a number of theories. The sort of most commonly talked about theory is a theory that was put forward in the way back in the 1920s by a gynecologist called Samson, who proposed that it was related to what we call retrograde menstruation. So this is where menstrual tissue goes back through the fallopian tubes and then seems to spill out into the pelvic cavity. The problem with this theory is that we now know that 80 to 90% of women experience retrograde menstruation. It's probably a normal phenomenon. So the big question is, why in some women does this tissue stick, implant and form these endometriosis, what we call lesions within the pelvis or on the ovaries? And of course, it doesn't explain why sometimes endometriosis gets further away in the body. We are working in Edinburgh to try and understand why women develop endometriosis. We spent a number of years asking patients who are undergoing surgery if we can look at their tissues and looking at it in the laboratory. And one explanation that we've come across is that women with endometriosis seem to have higher levels of something called lactate in the pelvis. And we know from other studies that high levels of lactate seem to sort of stimulate some of the steps involved in the development of an endometriosis lesion. So we think that potentially that's something that's important for the development of endometriosis, and it's something we're looking at targeting in terms of developing new drug treatments.
Considering the numbers 1 in 10, you know, I know quite a few people who've got endometriosis, but I think because of the area that I work in, and I mainly work with females, but it doesn't feel like endometriosis gets a huge amount of airtime. Is that accurate?
Yes, I mean, I think there's been a big shift, fortunately, and I think I don't know what Louise thinks, but in the last, I'd say, 5 years, it's been talked about a lot more, and all credit to the BBC, The Guardian, you know, journalists who've started to bring it into the mainstream and start talking to patients with endometriosis. But I think the few points that Louise had made, I think that the problem was people don't like talking about women's problems. I think sometimes people were maybe told, well, bad periods run in the family, so that's normal, or told by their teacher or their friends it's normal to have pain, and also maybe just feel embarrassed about talking about it. And I think also there's that aspect. But even within the medical profession, there was perhaps a lack of understanding around endometriosis. And Louise highlighted upon a really important point, which is the symptoms have crossover with other conditions as well, which make it difficult to diagnose just by what we call taking a history, talking to a patient. There are certain what we call red flags, which would be very severe period pain or cyclical pain, which make you think of endometriosis, but not everybody presents with them. So that makes it difficult to sort of start that diagnostic process. And then, of course, the huge problem that we have is that we don't have a simple test for diagnosing it. We still largely rely on surgery, laparoscopy, keyhole surgery, which requires a general anaesthetic to make the diagnosis. And we don't have a blood test or a urine test that can simply be used. So I think that all of this contributes to this big delay in diagnosis that we hear about, sadly, all too often.
It's also really difficult to kind of quantify pain as well, because I remember I went to a boarding school, so I lived with 90 girls, you know, in a very close proximity, and periods were talked about a lot for me. But maybe if you're in a family where you're the only daughter, you know, maybe in a mixed school, it might not be so much. But I do remember a really good friend of mine, every time it was her period, she would be in so much pain, hot water bottles, painkillers, you know, lying around, obviously in a lot of pain. But I guess it's difficult to know, you know, what's painful for one person might be different for someone else. And so maybe she was kind of thinking, well, maybe this is normal, you know, maybe everyone just has different pain thresholds, or, you know, maybe everyone's period pain is a bit different. And so if you just think it is just that you've got painful periods, probably not going to get it investigated. And it was the same for her. It was only when she then started trying for children that she then really finally got a diagnosis. So do you think that's it? It's almost that because we don't know much about it and it's not talked about much, and periods can be just in general quite painful, that there's almost this misdiagnosis, or people don't think that there's anything wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I know Endometriosis UK, for example, and in Edinburgh, we've been trying to do some work with younger people in schools. We put together a little cartoon talking about when is period pain normal, when is it not normal. And it is really difficult. And I always say to people, if you've got pain at any time that's interfering with your ability to enjoy something, to work, to study, to have relationships, then that isn't normal, and you shouldn't have to put up with that. But you're right. I think people, because pain isn't visible, as it were, like some other medical problems, people kind of, they can cover it up as well. And they learning to live with it is the wrong word, but they sort of start to cope with it. And I think, Louise, you've alluded to that as well. And that sometimes doesn't help a person, because they're not then putting themselves forward and saying that this is a problem, and so it gets missed in that respect.
It's a bit like back pain as well. I think it's harder to empathize with somebody when, you know, if someone's arm's hanging off, you know they're going to be in pain. It's like you said, it's very visible. But when it's pain that is not visible, it's quite hard to empathize with somebody or receive empathy. You found that, Louise?
Definitely. I used to really struggle with this, because I would, because you couldn't see, well, I didn't know what my symptoms were, but because you couldn't see them, you can't see my pain, you can't see my tiredness or whatever it was at the time, I'd cancel so many social events, because I would get to it and I'd be like, I'm just in so much pain, I can't go. And I used to feel so bad. I'd be saying, you know, I just can't come, I'm in pain. And if somebody's thinking, oh, you've just got a painful period, you're made to feel a bit pathetic, really. And no one said that to me, but I always felt like, because they have periods and they don't have that pain, they must be just thinking, oh, just get on with it, you know. And it's, I remember actually going to a GP even, and this was when we had been struggling to conceive. And she was asking me loads and loads of questions. And she said, and what about your periods? Are your periods normal? And I like clearly remember the questions thinking, well, I don't know. I don't know what normal is, like, but it's normal to me. And I said to her, they are super painful. You know, they stop me in my tracks. I have to have a lot of time off work. And she then responded, she said, okay, so pretty normal, just painful periods. And I was like, and that just reinforced to me, oh, like it is normal, like everybody else is going through this. I am just being like really silly about it and just like a bit weak. But it's definitely really hard when you can't show it to someone. And to my partner as well, to Faisal, like, he's like super positive, super strong, fit guy, and I'm there just like, oh, get me a hot water bottle, I'm dying. I just felt ridiculous. Like, I felt in my mind I should just get on with it, but for him it must have been so hard because he can't see anything that's wrong with me. Like, obviously he saw the pain, and at times he saw it really, really badly, you know. But yeah, I think it's still definitely difficult to sympathize with or empathize with someone when you can't see anything going on.
Especially it's a hard one. Realize that they've got endometriosis. You know, if you're still thinking that is normal. And that's so interesting hearing you saying, you know, how your periods felt for you, and a GP saying, well, that's quite normal. Because for me, you know, I barely even notice my periods.
Yeah. Well, I know that now, because now I don't. So now I'm like, God, that's like my period will come on now. And I remember the first period I had actually after having my surgery, I was with my dad, and I never talk about periods with my dad. I'm sure he's very happy that I don't. But I remember coming onto my period, and it was a complete shock. I wasn't expecting it because I'd had no pain at all. And I couldn't remember the last time that had happened without days and days of pain before it. And I just burst out crying. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it's worked. It's worked. I've got no pain. And it was just the most amazing feeling. And that's when it really hit me. I was like, God, that really wasn't normal. Like, I did not need to suffer for as long as I did. It's crazy how much it affected my life. And I still thought it was just fairly normal.
And Andrew, hearing that, we can understand then why you're so passionate about this topic, because it does have such a huge effect on women's life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really struck me, I think, when I finished my medical training and became took the step to becoming a consultant, that first of all, it was a condition, or at least pelvic pain, the symptom of endometriosis, was something that we dealt with a lot in gynecology where I work, but that we really weren't very good at managing it. And I think many clinicians sort of shied away from it because they didn't know how to manage it, which, you know, then has this knock-on effect onto patients. So it was around that time I started to think, oh, I wanted to make some changes locally, and we set up a centre in Edinburgh, and we tried to involve other clinicians from other disciplines because, you know, as I'm sure you both know, it's not a condition that can just be managed by gynaecologists. And then at the same time, I started to develop much more of a research interest in it. We built up a group in Edinburgh, and that's kind of where it's all started from. And I feel incredibly passionate about it. And if I can do any little thing to make some changes, I'll be very proud.
Yeah, I bet. And like Louise mentioned, I guess for you, a lot of the emphasis is going to have to be on educating GPs, because they're the first person that's going to hear the symptoms. You know, it takes a lot to be then referred further along. So it's making sure that GPs have the most recent information and they know when to be able to pass this on, and what is a normal period and what isn't a normal period.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as being a GP is not easy. You know, they're seeing so many patients, they've got so little time, they have to know so much about so many different conditions. So I think it's making that information accessible. So, I mean, I just think the more we talk about endometriosis, then the more, you know, that's only got to be a good thing, because not only does it educate the public, but it makes GPs, doctors, anybody who sees patients think about it as well.
Parents have a big role in that as well then, because, you know, we're the ones dealing with young girls who are starting to have their periods, and the more we know, the more we can also be able to say no when our daughters are suffering and more than they're supposed to be.
Yeah, and I think it wasn't until recently that people in the medical profession used to talk about endometriosis being a disease of people or women in their 30s and 40s. But it's not, you know, it can affect women of any age. Usually up until the menopause, but we do still see cases after the menopause. But I think really, as clinicians, as parents, as friends, if we see young people, adolescents who are suffering from period pain, we do need to be thinking about endometriosis, and above all, trying to think about how we can help and support these people and manage their pain.
Because if you're mentioning, Louise, about how, you know, you'd have to call in sick for work when it was so painful, you're going to have teenagers who are having to take time off school as well. And, you know, that has such a knock-on effect.
This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by The Bump Plan. Given the theme of this podcast, I imagine that some of you are currently pregnant or planning a family. So many women I know just aren't sure how to move their body safely during this changing time. Or they want to stay active but need someone to show them the way and hold their hand. That's where the Bump Plan comes in. The Bump Plan is a holistic prenatal fitness plan that allows you to work out with confidence at each trimester of your pregnancy. Founded by myself, Holly Grant, the Bump Plan has already helped over 10,000 pregnant women stay active safely and feel empowered throughout their pregnancies. Through its trimester-specific workouts, in which I'm always at the same stage of my pregnancy as you will be in yours, hypnobirthing subscription and extensive education hub, you'll feel supported and part of a welcome community. Let me help you move safely through your pregnancy, maintain your fitness and strength, and enter parenthood strong and prepared for all the demands it poses. As a listener of Bun in the Oven, I'm offering you £5 per month off the cost of your monthly subscription to the Bump Plan, simply by entering the code BUN at checkout. To get started today, simply head to pilatespt.co.uk/the-bump-plan and enter the code BUN at checkout. That's B-U-N in lowercase to get £5 off the monthly cost of the Bump Plan. Join our community today and stay strong throughout your pregnancy.
I read actually on Endometriosis UK's site, Andrew, that they think that it takes about 7.5 years to diagnose somebody. Is that still the thought?
Yeah, it's a very sad figure. So this is really from the time that someone presents with symptoms or to the medical profession to actually receiving the diagnosis. And that diagnosis at the moment, as I say, is surgery. And we've talked a little bit about the number of reasons. One is around awareness. The next bit is around this kind of overlap of the symptoms. And then the next bit that's contributing is the lack of the biomarker, the test. So I think in terms of trying to change that, we need a sort of multi-stranded approach. So awareness campaigns and Endometriosis UK have been fantastic in doing that. Education of clinicians, GPs about the symptoms, thinking about red flag symptoms, and then investment in research to try and develop a non-invasive biomarker. I was delighted to see our First Minister in Scotland put reducing time to diagnosis in her manifesto, and she's made a very bold statement to say that she's going to reduce it from the current 7.5 years to 1 year within her next time. So it's a great thing to be able to, for us to push for, given that she's put this in the manifesto.
That was a question I had for you, because I know that obviously for you guys, funding into research is so important. And I was thinking, where do we even start? Who funds it? Is it the government, or do you hope that somebody will privately fund something like this? You know, if you need money for researching endometriosis, where do you get that from?
Yeah, so historically, women's health research in general has been really woefully funded, poorly funded, underfunded. That has changed. It's much better now. But endometriosis in particular was really badly funded. And then the funding opportunities are the government. So we have the research councils who can fund research. We then have charities who fund research, but there aren't many charities who specifically fund women's health research or for that matter, endometriosis. And then, as you say, donations. A few years ago, we set up an initiative, a priority setting and research initiative, where we invited people with endometriosis, clinicians and researchers, to put forward their top 10 research priorities. And we did multiple national surveys. And we were very lucky, because when we published the results of this in The Lancet, at the same time the Sun newspaper published it on the front page, and it's had quite a big impact, and it's meant there's been a lot more investment from the government, from funding bodies, but also this awareness around research, I think, has also meant that charities are, you know, looking at endometriosis more favourably from a research perspective. And we've been lucky in Edinburgh, we've been approached by people to donate money for research. And so I think there's a move, a positive move forward in this respect, which is great. But the more money we can get for research, obviously, the more progress we can make.
Yeah, and I hate to kind of drop the F word here, feminism, but am I right in thinking that typically if it is something that only happens to women, there's usually a bit less money or research going into it? Is that true?
Yeah, I think the problem was historically on boards that were awarding, you know, funding for research, it was generally populated by men. And obviously I'm a man, but to give, so I suppose one of the problems was that maybe wasn't at the top of their minds if endometriosis, if people weren't as aware about it and as aware of how common it was and what an impact it was, then if something came in that was in this area, people maybe didn't realise what a big impact research in that field would happen. And I think obviously now that things have changed and there are many more, well, women on these panels, we're much more aware of research, endometriosis. I think that has changed for the better, but you're absolutely right. And I think endometriosis not only suffered from being a women's health condition, but it suffered from being a pain condition because of exactly what you said, because it's an invisible condition. So that in itself has also contributed to the problem.
And we have to talk about periods, and, you know, women and men feel a little bit uncomfortable at times talking about periods and admitting that you're having pain during sex or that you are having painful periods is not always going to be something you shout from the rooftops like you might do something else.
Painful sex, I think, is something that we really don't talk about. And also as clinicians, we shy away from, you know, some people are embarrassed about it, but also we shy away from it because we don't really know what to do and we don't really know how to manage it. So to me, that's going to be the next step, is going to be tackling that problem and investing research into addressing that problem, because it's probably sadly a lot more common than we realise, because people just don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, and especially postnatally, you know, I work with a lot of postnatal clients, and if it's not a weak pelvic floor that means they think they'll never jump on a trampoline, it's actually potentially the opposite, or a lot of pain during sex. And I think they don't always know where to go with that one. So we've talked about what it is and about the prevalence of it. I know we've talked a lot about painful periods, but Andrew, can you just run through some of the other symptoms that people might be presented with? So maybe if there's a mum listening who thinks that their daughter might have it, or someone listening who thinks they might have it, what are the most common symptoms that someone has it?
So a full range of different types of pain. So painful periods, pain outside of periods, cyclical pain, pain opening bowels, pain passing urine, painful sex we talked about. But also, I mean, Louise highlighted a very important symptom, which is the fatigue that women with endometriosis experience, which obviously is a difficult one because it's a symptom that's associated with other conditions as well. But increasingly, you know, we're recognizing that as a problem. So there's this whole range of symptoms. And then it's not really a symptom as such, but an association, this difficulty getting pregnant. So that if you're starting to sort of piece together some of these symptoms and these problems, that's when alarm bells should be raised about endometriosis. We also know that endometriosis is maybe associated with other conditions. So some women with endometriosis are maybe more predisposed to asthma, for example, and to some autoimmune conditions as well. So these are all things that kind of raise alarm and might suggest that the condition is there.
Mm. And so, Louise, when you were diagnosed, it was around the time that you were trying for RAFI. When was the possibility of surgery brought into it? Because I think I actually met you just after you'd had your operation.
Yes, I had a scan and they identified something there. And she said it's potentially endometriosis. And then I was booked in for my laparoscopy. I think I waited. It was really long. I think it was like 9 or 10 months before I actually got my date for my laparoscopy. I had like other things in between whether he was looking at my egg count and bits and bobs like that. But yeah, it was months and months. And I remember at that time then just feeling panic because I'd already been trying for a baby for so long that it's so all consuming. It's just like, I need to get pregnant. And knowing you had to wait, like that was really, really hard for me. Because I think at that time I sort of made my mind up like, okay, something's wrong and I need it fixed. And it's just, you're just watching the clock, like, okay, is it time yet? So it was a long wait. Once they'd identified something from the scan to it being sort of acted on, it was a long wait. I don't know why.
10 months is a really long time to be waiting when you're trying for a baby, because even 1 month feels like a year when you're trying
for a baby. And you had that mental toll still in that time. It's not like you've given up and trying for a baby. So every month you've still got the negative pregnancy tests and the stress of trying and timing it with ovulation, and the mental toll on me, but also on us as a husband and wife was massive. And I think by the time I had my operation, we were just at breaking point. It was rough. It was really, really hard.
And they suggested, so as soon as you had your scan, your laparoscopy, they found out that you had it. And then was it an instant, we're going to give you an operation to fix this? Or
while I was in the operating theatre, they went in and investigated and said, if we find anything, we remove it. So it was done there and then. So I sort of woke up and they told me what they found and what they'd removed. I think there were two endometrioma on my right ovary which were removed, and they said actually one of them ruptured when they went in. So I was like, God, that happened in the operating theater and not like at home. I just remember coming around from that surgery, and I think I was sort of drugged up, but the first question I asked was, can I have my IVF now? Because I wasn't allowed to go on the wait list for IVF until sort of all of that stuff had been investigated or dealt with. And that was literally my first question when I came round, and she said, yeah. And I just sobbed. I was like, oh my God, I can have my IVF now. And it just felt like the most amazing. I mean, after surgery, you should be feeling like, I don't know, pretty rubbish, but I was just on a high. I was just like, oh, this is the first step to like me maybe having a baby and like moving towards, yeah, a more positive future, you know? A huge weight lifted when I woke up from surgery. It's amazing.
And is that kind of common? Is that how things would normally be treated when you start to think someone has endometriosis?
Yeah, so usually when somebody's listed or put on the waiting list for a laparoscopy for keyhole surgery, as Louise says, at that time, they're consented for removing the endometriosis at the same time. It slightly depends on what's found at the time of surgery. So sometimes if it's not straightforward, if the disease is maybe involving the bowel or the bladder, then we have to then come back and do the surgery at a later stage, perhaps with a colorectal surgeon or a urologist, obviously, so that the operation is done as safely as possible. But for the most part, we would try and remove the disease at the time of surgery. And the disease can be removed by burning it away with heat or with laser, or by cutting it out. I think increasingly, although the evidence isn't there as yet, we're thinking that cutting it out is better than destroying it or burning it. But it's one of these things where there's a lot of uncertainty until we actually do the operation, because a scan can help in some instances. So there are three subtypes of endometriosis. You can have superficial peritoneal disease, which is the commonest subtype, and that's disease that's largely on the wall of the pelvis, and you can't really see that on a scan because it's small amounts of disease. And then the next subtype is ovarian disease, which causes cysts on the ovaries, endometrioma, as Louise said, or sometimes people call them chocolate cysts because they've got dark altered blood inside them. And then there's deep disease, which forms nodules, often involving the bowel or the bladder. So the ovarian disease and the deep disease you can sometimes see on scans because it's bigger and it's easier to see. But the other types of disease you wouldn't necessarily know anything about until you did the surgery. So it is challenging in that respect, in that for both the patient and the clinician, you don't necessarily know what you're going to find until you actually do the operation.
And it must be a really difficult balancing act as well, because I'd imagine often you're working with women who, like you said, have realized that something's wrong because they haven't been able to get pregnant. You want to go in there and fix things for them, but equally they want to come out of it still being able to have children. And so I know someone who specifically said, you know, they felt that they were sort of having a bit of an argument with their surgeon, in so much that their surgeon was like, we're going to fix this for you, we're going to take everything out. And she was like, yeah, that's fine, but I do still also really want to have children, so please be careful. And you know, there was that kind of, I guess you've got slightly different not interests, you've got slightly different goals at the end
of it. You're absolutely right. It's a real kind of balance between, so obviously in an ideal world you want to take out all of the endometriosis and remove it all, but you want to make sure you do as little damage as possible. And if there's endometriosis involving the ovary, you inevitably, if you're trying to take it away, will take a bit of normal ovarian tissue away, and that has an impact upon fertility. So you're right, there's this balance between trying to get everything out and trying not to do damage to a woman's fertility. And similarly, if it's on the bowel or on the bladder, you don't want to cause irreparable bowel or bladder damage. So it can often be really technically difficult surgery.
When I remember being in hospital, but before I was having my surgery, we were in the ward and I was waiting to go down. And I remember the lady next to me, she was behind a curtain, and I just heard the word that the doctors had come back. I think maybe she'd gone down for surgery and she'd returned, and they were saying to her about needing a hysterectomy. And I don't know if that was linked to endometriosis or not, because I didn't know what the ward was. I didn't know if we were all in there for the same thing. But I remember hearing those words and just being like, oh, my God. Like, I was just so filled with fear going down there. Like, this could be so bad. Like, there could be so much that they can't see. I think that's why I was tearful when I came round as well. I was just so grateful that it wasn't everywhere, you know, all my organs and stuff like that. But is that a thing? Like, can it lead to sort of full hysterectomy?
I always say to people, when you think about endometriosis, it's tissue outside of the womb, outside of the uterus. So a hysterectomy isn't a treatment for endometriosis, because it's not really removing the problem, as it were. But there are some women who maybe have tried absolutely everything and get to the point where they request a hysterectomy, or in discussion with their surgeon have a hysterectomy, which does sometimes help, and we don't fully understand why. And it may be because there's another condition called adenomyosis, which is a bit like endometriosis, where you get tissue like the lining of the womb in the muscle of the wall of the womb, and you often can't see that on a scan, and you can't really detect it sometimes until you get into the laboratory and look at the womb after a hysterectomy. So sometimes people do end up with a hysterectomy and it helps them get better. I think though the main message to say is it's not a treatment, and people shouldn't feel forced into having a hysterectomy for endometriosis. And certainly nowadays, I think, nobody would, I hope no surgeon would do a hysterectomy without, you know, discussing it, unless it was life-threatening, etc. And it definitely wouldn't be something that would be done for endometriosis without lots and lots of discussion and counselling for exactly the reasons that you've said.
What a step before surgery. So, or is it that literally you've got endometriosis, we're going to need to go in and take some things out? Is there a tablet? Is there anything before that happens?
So it slightly depends on whether or not. So for example, in Louise's case, where she was trying to get pregnant and there was the fertility issue, you would tend to go to surgery straight away. But if you were someone who was presenting with pain as the primary issue, and where fertility at that time wasn't a problem, the guidance is that initially you'd be offered a 3 month treatment if you wanted, with, say, for example, a combined pill. And the rationale for that is that we know that endometriosis is stimulated by estrogen from the ovaries. So if you give any hormones, you can stop the ovaries temporarily producing estrogen and hopefully, you know, reduce the endometriosis and reduce the symptoms. So first line patients in general practice might be offered a short course of the combined pill. And then there are other ways later on, if, say, for example, surgery doesn't work or patients don't want surgery, that you can stop the ovaries producing estrogen. So you can give the hormone progestin in a number of different ways. You can give it by tablets, by injection, by implant. You can give it through a coil, and that can help with endometriosis pain. And then you can give a drug treatment called a GnRH agonist, which causes a temporary menopause. And this is a monthly injection that's actually given with hormone replacement therapy that again stops the ovaries producing estrogen that can be very effective. But the problem with all of these things is obviously they're not what we call fertility sparing. So you can't get pregnant if you're taking them. And they all have side effects. I mean, the pill usually has minor side effects, but some of these other treatments have more significant side effects. So it's always a balance between the pros and cons of each of these treatments. And I suppose similarly with surgery, you have to be aware as a patient of that surgery carries risks, the general anaesthetic, the procedure itself as well. So all of these things are a balance.
But there's options, which is
yeah. Yeah, I think the thing is, where we're at the moment is there are a number of options. The way I'd like us to move forward is to have more options that aren't contraceptive, but also be able to tell a patient, you know, maybe do a test or from something in their history, be able to say to them, this is your best option. Because I think at the moment it's often, these are all the options. Take your pick and we'll, by trial and error, we'll work out what's best for you, which I think is really must be incredibly frustrating for patients, and it's frustrating for us as doctors as well.
Yeah. Well, then, Louise, you had your surgery and that was great, and then you're allowed to go onto the list for IVF. Is it the case that you're then allowed to just go for IVF straight away, or is it try for 6 months, then we'll put you on IVF?
Yeah. By that point, we've been trying for about 2.5 years. Or probably more, actually. So we were allowed to sort of go straight on the list for IVF, but I mean, in the year building up to that, we'd had so many tests and scans, blood tests, Pfizer had gone through all sorts of stuff. So I don't know if that's the case with everybody, but yeah, we went straight on it. And actually, I don't know if you know this, but yeah, we actually fell pregnant 18 hours before we were due to, like the day before we were due to go in to start our IVF, whatever the start is, I don't know. But yeah, I just had them take a test and found out I was pregnant. And I couldn't believe it. And because of the battle we'd had, because of the endometriosis, I was just in absolute shock. And I remember so clearly, I called the IVF clinic. I hadn't even told Faisal, he was at work. I called the IVF clinic straight away, like in tears. And I was like, I'm meant to come in tomorrow for IVF and I'm pregnant. I've had a positive on a pregnancy test. And they were like, oh, okay, well, congratulations. I was like, no, you don't understand. I'm going to lose my place on the wait list for my IVF. And they were like, you don't need it, you're pregnant. I was like, no, I'm not pregnant. It's just saying that. And I just don't know how that's going to affect tomorrow. And they told me to do another test. I took like 3 at home. And they made me actually come into the hospital to the IVF unit to do a test there so that I could believe that I was pregnant. And they said, this is not going to be a false positive. This is a fourth, like you are pregnant. And I still hadn't told Faisal because I was like, I'm not going to tell him I'm pregnant because I physically can't get pregnant. It's not going to happen. So yeah, like I'm so thankful to my surgery. I don't know if it was my surgery that helped it or if it was just the stress had been lifted a little. I don't know, but I'm just so thankful that I had it done because now I've got Rafi, obviously, which is amazing.
You do hear that quite often, don't you? You can tell us if that is a thing or whether it's just that we've heard of it lots. But again, it happened to someone I know very well who had had her operations and then was told she needed to wait 6 months. Then when it finally came to, I don't know the order of this, but having to go in, I think, to have your injections to get everything ready to go. She had to wait until her period came, and her period was late. And she was like, no, I this is so typical. I've been waiting for this for ages. It isn't coming. And she was pushing. They said, have you thought about taking a pregnancy test? And she was like, I won't be pregnant. And then same, found out that she was pregnant, and now they have a child. Is this common, Andrew, or is it just?
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, I don't have any research to back this up, but anecdotally, we do see patients who have surgery and quite quickly afterwards become pregnant. And I don't know, I mean, Louise, you've made suggestions that I would make, whether this something that's disrupting or, you know, improving the environment so that a pregnancy can implant. We don't know. We do know for certain that surgery improves fertility chances if you have the superficial peritoneal type, so that commonest type. So if you remove that disease, that definitely significantly improves your chances of getting pregnant naturally. For other types of disease, so for example, if you have endometrioma, often that's done more to make IVF easier and more successful. So there are different reasons for doing the surgery in the context of fertility. But yeah, well, you know, I hear lots of positive stories after surgery, which is great.
And then how did that feel, Louise? Did you feel nervous through your pregnancy with Rafi, or did you kind of feel calm because it wasn't linked with miscarriage, linked with not getting pregnant?
Yeah, no, I was really not calm. My best friend actually had like miscarried. It just so happened like a couple of months before, so I think that was in my mind as well. But I just was so convinced that I couldn't get pregnant that I couldn't believe that I could stay pregnant. Like, you know, in my mind, internally, I was damaged, and it was so soon after my surgery. We announced it when I was sort of, I think I was 20 weeks, and that was kind of forced really, because I'd just gone into hiding. I didn't see anybody for like a good 5 months because I was so scared about it. Not even about losing my baby, but just that it wasn't real. Like I was almost lying to people that I was pregnant because I couldn't be pregnant. And the first 12 weeks I was an absolute nightmare. Just a nightmare. I can't even tell you how many private scans we paid for, because I was just like, I just need to check. And it was probably only when I started feeling him like moving and stuff that I had that reassurance every day, like, okay, I can feel him. It's okay. But yeah, now we're on the flip side, as you know, like we've just last year, I miscarried. So now I'm back to that thing of, okay, like something's wrong again, because we haven't been able to get pregnant since. I'm like, it's back. And that's what caused me to miscarry. And I'm an absolute paranoid wreck at the moment. But yeah, that's what I mean. It's just that it never goes away. Like, miscarriage is so, so normal. So many people have a miscarriage. I think it's 1 in 4 suffer miscarriage. But you think a lot deeper because your body's gone through so much. This is what I'm struggling with now. When I had my miscarriage, a lot of people said to me, well, at least you know you can get pregnant. And I was just like, oh no, you just don't understand. Like, it took 3 years with Rafi. I can't just get pregnant. Like, I got lucky the second time, but then I miscarried, and it's really hard to sort of, I don't want to keep going on to people. Like, you don't understand. It was 3 years. Like, it was a nightmare. Like, I can't just get pregnant. Like, it's hard.
It's so helpful to hear that, and even just as just for people to know what not to say to somebody, you know, to not say, at least you know you can get pregnant, because you have no idea how long it took, and you have no idea the journey somebody's been on to get to that point.
Mm. Yeah, it was really, really hard, because I think when we got pregnant the second time, the miscarriage we just suffered, I think for both of us, we were like really happy and really celebrating. And I was like, God, this is how it's meant to feel. Because the first time it was such a hard journey, and it was such mixed emotions, and we just didn't enjoy it for so long. I was like, this is it. Like, this is what it feels like when you try for a baby and you just get pregnant. It only took 2 months. I was like, this is like, yes, this is amazing. So then when we lost the baby, it was really hard. And yeah, I had so many of those comments, and I couldn't believe it, like, because people knew what I'd been through previously with Rafi. I was just like, oh, why are people so blasé? I guess people are just trying to be positive, but it's a real toxic positivity, you know. Like, I just think when you miscarry, sorry to go on a completely different subject, but I just think any sentence that starts with "at least," just don't say it, because there's like, sometimes there's no silver lining. It's just a crap time. Like, it's just rubbish. I don't need to be told, you know, at least it only took 2 months, at least you can try again. Like, there's no at least. It's just rubbish.
There's something that people should say if they're speaking to someone who said that they've had a miscarriage. Is there something that you wanted to hear, or someone said to you that did offer you reassurance?
I think you just need, you don't need, it's not something that has a solution or like magic words can take away the pain. Or, you know, even on the days when I wasn't feeling, I was feeling okay, I was feeling really strong and positive, people would say, you know, it's okay to be sad. And then I was like, God, now I feel bad that I'm not sad. Like, just let me get on with it. Let me process it. I think the best thing you can say is probably just, I'm sorry. I'm here for you. if you want to talk, I'm here, I'm listening, like, can I do anything to help? Just like, you know, I'm sorry is enough. Like, I'm not expecting somebody to like ring me up and have magic words that will take it all away. Yeah. But yeah, just, I don't need a solution. Not, I didn't need a solution, I think, at that time.
Sometimes we want to fix it, don't we? And actually, yeah, just need to give somebody a hug.
Yeah, exactly, definitely.
So Andrew, is when someone has had surgery from endometriosis, does that tend to be it, or is it something that comes back and then needs readdressing, or do you not really have enough evidence yet?
Unfortunately, as Louise said, there isn't a cure for endometriosis, and so whilst lots of people get better after surgery, some people don't find, a proportion of people don't find surgery of any benefit, sadly. We don't know why that is. But the statistics in terms of success of surgery in whom patients do have benefit are that around 20% after 2 years will have a recurrence of their symptoms, and up to 50% will have a recurrence of their symptoms at 5 years. So sadly, it's certainly not a cure when you look at those figures, and then people may end up going on to have further surgeries or look to some of those other treatments that we discussed earlier.
So Louise, what would your advice be to anyone that's listening to this that either thinks they have endometriosis or has endometriosis? Have you kind of learned anything along the way that you would want to share with someone else?
I think listen to your gut. Like, don't go into a GP and, like, sometimes we think doctors are God and they know everything, but sometimes actually you do really need to push. And I think since I spoke about it on social media at the time, I had so many women that came forward and a few that had gone to the GP, and I said, just specifically say you want to be investigated for endometriosis, like, put it in their head. And then they found out that actually they did have it. But yeah, I just think you need to feel empowered to sort of ask those questions, and yeah, just make your voice heard. I would say if you're having a period every month and you're taking painkillers every month and the painkillers still aren't taking the edge off the pain, like, something's wrong. It might not be endometriosis, but see your doctor. Like, don't delay it. I think I went through so much pain before I really, really acted on it and, like, got the answers that I needed. The other thing with endometriosis is that has a long-lasting impact. Like, that's really, like, massively affected my ovarian reserve now. So while I'm not in the pain, there's stuff that can't be reversed because it's gone on for so long. So, yeah, I would say listen to your gut, make your voice heard, but also don't expect a cure. There isn't one. Like, I'm grateful, like, it gave me Rafi, but I read something the other day that is the surgery is kind of like shaving. You don't get to the root of the problem. It's always going to, like, grow back, or it's always there, you know. So don't expect the world, and just talk about it. Like, sharing your story can help others in their journey, and it's just comforting. Like, I just love talking about everything. Now I put everything on Instagram because it just helps. It really helps to talk about it. You feel less alone, and you're helping people who might not know anything about it. And that's a positive thing. At least something good comes from it.
And the same as you being on here today, you know, you've talked about some things that are really private to you, and also, you know, must have been really difficult to talk about, but your honesty might then help one other woman. And I know that that would just make you so happy. And so, yeah, thank you so much for speaking about it today.
You're welcome. It's lovely to talk.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And it's so, and it's lovely to just, yeah, to, for people to be able to not feel alone. Mm-hmm. Andrew, would you have any advice to add to that then from your kind of background?
I think not anything particular to add. I'd just echo what Louise said. You know, don't suffer in silence. Go to your GP. Tell, you know, exactly as Louise said, if you think there's something not right, tell your GP you think something's not right. Take information with you if you have information about endometriosis. Help your GP come to the diagnosis. And if you're not getting anywhere with that doctor, go and see another doctor. I think, as Louise said, there's some great support groups around as well. So talk to them, get support from other people who have the same problem, the same condition, because that always helps. And again, as Louise said, we just need to keep talking about it.
Not just talking about endometriosis, but just talking about periods in general. Like, we all bleed, we all fart, we all poo. It's a normal thing. Like, I was a police officer when I had endometriosis, and I never would have gone into my team and said anything about having, like, a painful period. Like, no way. But now, like, I don't care. Like, if I'm on my period, the whole world knows about it. Just normalize it.
Yeah, it is so true. And it's the same with, you know, obviously I work with lots of pregnant women and postnatal women, and postnatally, you know, we tend to hide away from admitting whether we've had an episiotomy, or, you know, like we said, whether we've got pain during sex, or we leak when we jump, you know. And actually, we would be really pleasantly surprised. We'd be very surprised if we actually knew how many other women that was happening to. But if we don't open up and tell people, they are probably not going to also say the same back. Andrew, where would you direct somebody online? Obviously, there's the Endometriosis UK, which you're a trustee for, aren't you? Is that a good place for people to go and get info?
Yes, I think that's a really good place to start. And certainly if they can't help, they'll direct you to places that can help. So definitely Endometriosis UK.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. I mean, I could talk to you both for another hour, but I'm aware that, that you've both got very important jobs to go back and do. So I cannot stress how grateful I am to both of you, Louise, for being so open with us, and Andrew, for your incredible knowledge, and also for doing so many amazing things for endometriosis and hopefully the future of diagnosis and treatment. So thank you both of you so much.
Holly, can I also say thank you to you, because you do an amazing job for women out there, and like normalizing like all these issues, periods, peeing when you trampoline, all this stuff. Like you're honestly, you're doing such an amazing job. I love you. I think you're amazing. And yeah, you're awesome. You rock. And you're a mum. You're doing it all as a mum. You're amazing.
Got a very supportive husband. But what I do always say is, and I hope you don't mind me saying this in front of you, Andrew, I know Louise won't mind, she's potty mouth, but I'm not here to get laid. You know, I've got a husband. I'm not here to look sexy or to want people to sleep with me. I just want women to not feel so embarrassed and not put up with, you know, painful sex or weeing every time you jump. And so... you know, anything that we can do, even if it means admitting it myself, then that's what we'll do. Thanks, everybody, and thanks so much, guys.
Thanks.
Right, bye. See you later. Bye. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Firstly, I want to say a huge thank you to my guests today for being so open and honest about personal topics on such a public platform. That takes real bravery and will help so many others. I genuinely believe that one person's honesty can help free many. If you found today's episode helpful, please do head to the show notes to find links and support our guests feel may be useful. Secondly, this podcast can only help those who know about it. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would mean so much to me if you could rate us with a 5-star rating and leave us a review, or hit follow to be the first to hear when our next episode lands. While podcasts are easy to listen to, they take a lot of effort to create, and your support in sharing Bun in the Oven will help me encourage more guests to join me for future episodes. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and enjoy the rest of your day.